Hi, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us, both to our in-person audience and our extensive online audience. My name is Julie McCarty, and I'm a Knowledge Management Specialist with the USAID Bureau for Food Security. And I'd like to welcome you all to the January edition of our Ag Sector Council seminar series. For those of you who are not aware, Ag Sector Council is a monthly seminar put on by the Bureau for Food Security and the Feed the Future Initiative, and put on by our knowledge-driven agricultural development mechanism, our excellent team, who is mostly there in the back running the webinar. We are always happy to focus on events that are of high relevance to our ag development practitioners, food security practitioners, our missions, and we're always open for new ideas. So my email will be at the end of this presentation. If you have suggestions for future topics, highly pressing topics that you think would be good for this series, feel free to bring them to me. For this particular seminar, we wanted to focus on soils because 2015 is the International Year of Soils. And our agrilinks.org platform is going to be putting out a whole range of blog posts, events, and resources on the soils topic. And if you're on our AgriLinks mailing list, you will get notified of those. So we have a lot to delve into today, so we'll get started in just a moment. I always like to remind people to please turn off your cell phones or silence them so that we don't interrupt the speakers. Also, just to let you know, this seminar is being recorded for our online audience and for a resource that we'll post on agrilinks.org, partly because it's being recorded and partly for our online audience. When you ask a question, we'd like to pass the microphone around to you. So generally, please hold your questions until the end of the seminar, although if you have a burning clarification question, do feel free to raise your hand, and we'll make sure to pass you a mic. And let's see. I think that is about all for our housekeeping issues. So to introduce our speakers and to just give a very brief introduction to the soils topic, I'd like to pass the mic to Jerry Glover, who is an agricultural ecologist with the USAID Bureau for Food Security on our research team. So Jerry?
Thank you. Good morning, and happy International Year of Soils. It's great. As my background's primarily in soil science, so it's great to see the focus on soils. And in our research work, our development work in Africa, particularly in Africa, but also in Asia, many of the biggest challenges we face are around soils. A lot of people don't really internalize the idea that when we're building flesh and bones and tissue of humans and animals, those nutrients, magnesium, phosphorus, potassium, come from the soil. And farmers trying to get those nutrients concentrated into plants and in a form that we can eat and consume and grow and be healthy is pretty challenging, especially in these challenging soils that we find in many parts of Africa and some parts of Asia. So it was great to see these two gentlemen come in to talk about the difficulties that farmers often have in adopting best management practices for soils when they're also trying to, at least in the short term, produce the highest yields, get great economic returns without diverting too much of their resources to building the soil. But of course, long-term soil is very important. So there's often at least the appearance of trade-offs between the long-term soil health and short-term economic returns, short-term yields. So to look at those trade-offs and discuss the complexities of it, I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Ephraim Kanya from the International Food Policy Research Institute. He's a senior research fellow there. He's done a lot of work on the economics of land degradation, both in Africa and Asia. He's worked on several USAID projects, so he's pretty familiar with our development community. And then, of course, Dr. Keith Moore, who many of you may know from Virginia Tech and his long-standing work with the Sustainable Agriculture and Natural Resource Management, CRISP, which is now the Innovation Lab. Keith did a lot of work on that, and actually, just to highlight some of his work, he's the author of this wonderful piece, The Sciences and Art of Adaptive Management, looking at some of these trade-off issues and the behavior change necessary in smallholder households. I will also say Keith is now the executive director of the Office of International Research, Education, and Development there at Virginia Tech. So he oversees, helps manage, coordinate the various international programs, some of which are funded by USAID. So his work is very relevant. So with that, I'll open it up for Keith Moore.
Well, thank you, Jerry. I need to make a clarification in the interests of proper advertising and all. I'm not the author of the book. I'm the editor. And that is an important issue because it takes all of us working together to solve problems. And we'll probably come back to that topic later as we move through this. Let's see what we got on these. Oh, that's me. F. Ephraim. That's the title of the presentation, Technological Change in Soil Management Practices, Context and Innovation. That's what we're going to talk about today. It's based on a 30-year review of literature and observation of the uptake of soil management practices. Agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa is constrained by degraded soils, limiting the productivity of small farmers who manage that land. Various practices have been suggested to improve soil fertility. Yet despite the potential for soil management technologies to improve soil fertility, studies examining the uptake of these technologies have demonstrated no universally predictive factors influencing adoption. So we just don't know what the silver bullet is. Integrated soil fertility management is a framework to understand and promote improved practices which will maintain sustainability and improve production. It's defined by Van Lau as a set of soil fertility management practices that necessarily include the use of fertilizer, organic inputs, improved germplasm combined with knowledge on how to adapt these practices to local conditions, aiming at maximum agronomic use efficiency of the applied nutrients, and improving crop productivity. All inputs need to be managed following sound agronomic principles. There are different parts to this definition that are worth noting. One is the underlining of the significance of local conditions and local context and the need for adaptation. Also, integrated soil management fertility management is not a simple technology, it's a complex one. And we'll come back to that complexity thing later. The other part of this definition stresses the scientific nature of the practices. Okay, so our objectives. How can we better understand what drives small farmer decision making? How can we leverage that understanding to foster innovation in agricultural practices? That's where we're going to go today. We're going to do this in two phases. First, in order to better understand farmer decision making, I'll analytically distinguish between two phases, the process of agricultural innovation leading to changes in soil management. The first phase is framing the problem, specifying its context, and the consequent choices then that small farmers face. The second phase will address the consequent farmer decision-making processes with respect to innovation diffusion and technological change. We're going to frame the problem here in the first phase. We're going to talk about differences in perception about what soil fertility is and means to the different actors, primarily those scientists and extension agents and the farmers. We're going to take a look quickly at some economic factors affecting the smallholder enterprises and then discuss a bit about faith-based framings of agricultural knowledge. After framing the problem, I'll turn the floor over to Ephraim, who will provide some concrete examples of the adoption of soil management practices. And then later I'll come back and discuss the paradigm or the changing paradigm of adoption, adaptation, and innovation. And then we can discuss the implications for scaling up improved soil management practices. Okay, farmer knowledge and perception of soil health and soil fertility often differs from that of research scientists and extension agents. While scientists measure soil fertility through chemical analyses, farmers rely on visual assessment of crop performance. Farmers rely on visual assessment of crop performance based on yield. Scientists are looking at the chemicals, the nitrogen, the phosphorus, the manganese, and all those chemicals that Jared mentioned that I can't keep track of. I'm sorry. And neither can the farmer, because they're looking at the output, the yield, and the color of the soil, the presence of weeds. Scientists and farmers have different objectives. While scientists focus on maximizing soil quality for improved production, farmers seek to optimize soil use in trade-offs with other livelihood priorities. This all leads to very different perspectives when scientists and farmers meet to discuss soil fertility. Agricultural scientists and extension agents frequently blame the practices of smallholders for the degradation that occurs. And indeed, many adoption studies perceive a choice between the traditional, perceived as an inferior technology, and the innovation, which is perceived as the superior technology, universal. On the other hand, farmers feel their insights and their knowledge ignored in the process. Scientists and farmers, nevertheless, have the potential to enrich one another's knowledge of soil fertility and improve the capacity for innovation. But there are many challenges, as you can see, in this confrontation of perspectives to competent communication. Okay, the economic context. Small farmers are operating small holdings, which are mixed production and consumption units. Farmers' economic framing of choices is driven by their perception of financial outcome, income stability, and food security. Agricultural outputs are only a part of their economic concerns. The farm household's consumption and production activities are inseparable. Off-farm income is often necessary to supplement income and food from farm production. This and other forms of diversification are measures to protect against livelihood risk. Investment trade-offs are significantly more complex in a mixed production consumption unit than in a farm and viewed as purely a production unit. This creates uncertainty as to the validity of econometric analyses which view the farm as purely production unit. And there is growing but still insufficient research which examines the farm household through this mixed production-consumption lens. Finally, I'd like to take a look for a moment at the role of faith-based knowledge. The adoption of innovations is more than simply a matter of how knowledge is produced and validated in the biophysical and economic dimensions. It also involves farmers' broader attitudes, beliefs, and practices. Spiritual and religious beliefs within the community significantly shape how choices are framed. A person's religious belief helps frame a worldview that influences farm management decisions and perceptions of agricultural problems. The promotion of conservation and agriculture has tapped into this. Faith-based organizations, international donors, and non-governmental organizations have been at the forefront of promoting conservation agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa, utilizing the Judeo-Christian ethic of environmental stewardship, citing biblical texts that place emphasis on caring for God's creation. In fact, the example of Zimbabwe is rather interesting. The moldboard plow, in fact, was first introduced as something of through the Christian community as an improvement and a matter of promoting the Christian in the country. It's linked together in the process. By contrast, an ex-tobacco farmer who became a convert to Christianity in Zimbabwe developed conservation agricultural practices based on a revelation he had. He noted that in the world of in the natural world, there's no natural process that turns over the soil. That's a purely artificial thing. So that the natural process was to have a bed of leaves and branches and grasses to cover the soil and protect it, which he called God's blanket. And that has been the basis for a good deal of promotion of conservation agriculture across southern Africa. Some of these practices have been adopted in situations where they were not agriculturally sound, but the point is that the religious faith and tying in with it, the group nature of that, can be very powerful in terms of scaling up adoption. Traditional beliefs also are an important frame of reference for agricultural decision making. Okay, so what have we learned so far here? Farmers and scientists see the world differently, with different lenses and different objectives. Economic factors shaping integrated soil fertility management choices extend beyond the field and farm to include complex farm household livelihood systems. And finally, ideologies and religions can be mobilized to help frame integrated soil fertility management choices. Decision making cannot be isolated from its context. So I'd like to stop here, remembering we tried to set a context and let Efren take over for a while. I'll pass you the baton.
Okay, thank you. So let me show that we compare the ISFM where there is a combination of inorganic inputs, organic inputs and inorganic inputs. And we looked at the variance of yields over time. And the first one, this was a study in Uganda, and this is a cross-section. We looked at the farmers, the ones who are combining and the ones who are not, and the ones who are just using inorganic fertilizer. But you can see the graph is good. It's telling you that this is the log of yield, which is the strong line, this one. It first declines as this is the log of carbon, soil carbon. Look, it declines and then it climbs up, which is good. We need higher yields. Look at the risks. First of all, it increases, then it goes down. So somebody who has carbon at this level has both higher yields and lower risks, which is good. Now let's go to this. This was this simulation, DSAT simulation model, and we looked at different management practices from the one which is 100 crop residues are retained in the plot, and then this one, manure, 1.7 tons, and 50% of crop residues are retained, and so on and so forth. As you go from left to right, the risk is declining. And this was a 30-year period of simulation telling you that if you have more carbon in the soil, the yield risks are reducing. And all those climate-related risks, which are very frequent, especially in dry areas, that's something which is good. Now, we also look at the ISFM over a long period of time. Again, 30 years, this was a simulation where the farmers are not applying anything over the 30-year period. The yields changed. It declined by over quite a lot. But as you increase the crop residues and manure, and this is manure, it is not showing, but manure plus the fertilizer here, you see that it's sustainable over a long period of time. The yields are not declining. Again, this is good news for ISFM that it increases yield, it also reduces the yield risks. All those things are very good. Now, Van Laar, where Keith has just defined, he was saying biological efficiency, but we economists are saying that ISFM is also optimal in economics, that you get more money when you combine the two. And look, now again, move from left to right. This is all zero. They are not applying manure. They are not applying the organic input. Anything, nothing. And then you retain 100% of the crop residues, and you continue all the way to the right. You see the profit for both rice and maize is increasing as you move from left to right. Again, this is something which was done for only Nigeria, and it is only telling us that ISFM is more profitable than the land grading management practices. Now, we tried to compare two, and this was a study which we did in these countries, Malawi, Uganda, Nigeria, and Kenya. We looked and we compared two management practices. One, which you are applying the recommended rate of 80 kilograms of nitrogen without putting organic inputs. And then we combine that with half of the rate, which is 40 kilograms of nitrogen, but you put 1.7 tons of manure. Now, look at the comparison. In all cases, in all countries, the one that you are combining manure and inorganic fertilizer at half the rate, recommended rate, is more profitable than the one where you are only applying the recommended rate of 80 kilograms of nitrogen without putting manure. This is very good, and this is, you are not taking into account the benefit of the reduction of the yield variance. Again, this is something which is very good, telling us that with ISFM, we can reduce the amount of fertilizer by half, which is very good. Now, look at the subsidies. I'm going to talk about the subsidies. They are not subsidizing the organic input. They are only subsidizing one thing, fertilizer. That's it. This is what we call the unholy cross. Why? Because it is illogical. It should not be like this. We looked at, this was a cross LSM surveys, and we looked at them, and we looked at the adoption rate of ISFM. Now, the strange thing is that ISFM adoption rate, which is in blue histogram, is the lowest. But where the farmers who are applying nothing, they are the majority. But look at the profit, which is the orange histogram. It is the highest here, and it will go down as you go this way. Now, why this unholy cross? It's unholy because it is illogical. It was supposed to, these lines were supposed to be actually parallel to each other, all of them rising, but that's not the case. Something is wrong. Why? This farmer is asking this question. Now, we also did a study, and this study was very interesting. We went to agricultural extension agents in Nigeria and Uganda. We asked them, what messages do you give to your farmers? The first message was improved seeds. The second one, inorganic fertilizer. The third one was agrochemicals. There was only 1% of the extension agents who were saying anything about organic inputs. So the teachers are ignorant. They are not telling the farmers the right thing to do. If they're not talking about the organic inputs, that's something which should be fixed. And let me go back. There was no one who reported to tell the farmers anything about climate change. Again, the extension agents who are supposed to be educating the farmers need to be educated themselves. They don't have a clue of what's going on and what should be done. And the ISFM that we are talking about is something which is not very old. It's a new knowledge. And it is about 30 years old. And before that, there wasn't much talk about that. So the people who went to school 20 years ago need to go back to school. A lot of things have changed. Climate change came, but this is a new thing again. They don't know anything about that. Now, the other problem is this. Aside from the extension agents who don't give the knowledge to the farmers, ISFM is also labor intensive. When you are using manure, the one that we were using, that's also a problem, that you have to haul the manure from the car at the house, and then you put it to a plot. It requires animals to transport, and also it requires a lot of labor. That's something which is a problem, and there is a solution to that. In our analysis, we found that 50% of the cost of production, and for us, cost of production includes even the family labor, which they are not paying, but there is an opportunity cost of using your own labor. We took that into account. 50% of that was accounted for by labor, meaning that ISFM is labor intensive when you are using manure as the organic input that we are talking about. Now, these are the results that I was just showing. And we also looked at the gender distribution of adoption rate. We found that women are more likely to adopt the organic inputs, but less likely to adopt the inorganic fertilizer, for a reason that we know very well because of poverty and other things. Men are more likely to adopt the ISFM and more likely to adopt inorganic fertilizer alone. There is also lack of public investment into ISFM and organic inputs, and we looked at this fertilizer for these countries, Malawi, Zambia, Ghana, Tanzania, and Nigeria, and they are spending quite a lot of money on this. Look at the subsidies. They are quite generous. This is 60 to 80% of the price, almost free, right? And it is also only going to inorganic fertilizer, nothing about agroforestry or anything like that. So this is a problem that our governments are also ignorant. Our governments, who are supposed to be helping the farmers, they're also ignorant of the benefits that we have for ISFM. So what could be done to increase adoption of ISFM? And these are the things that will be very, very interesting. We did a study in Malawi, which gives the most generous subsidies, and we wanted to look at the incentives. By the way, I'm an economist, and I don't support subsidies, but I go by Francis, who said that, well, if you can't, God help me to accept things that I can't change and to change things that I can. So even for us economists, I'm now looking at the subsidies that I can't tell the governments in Tanzania not to give them, but if they give them, what can they do? And that's something which we did in this case. We looked at different... I'm sorry. I'll go back. What we did the voucher, which is given on the condition that if you have planted agroforest trees, then we're going to give you the voucher. This is something very good, because if they do that, meaning that Malawi now can cut by half the amount of money they are spending on subsidies, but still the yields are going to be higher than the yields they are currently giving, but they are only supporting inorganic fertilizer. And we also looked at the rainfall insurance and also giving them cash. The results are very interesting. The results show that, first of all, there was no farmer who did not respond to this incentive. All the farmers said, well, if you give me that condition, I'm going to plant the trees. That's very good news. But one thing which was interesting is that, look, compare this, the insurance and the subsidy. The majority of the farmers were actually going to this because of they are used to this subsidy, and that's why you see that there is a lot of them who are choosing that. And the key finding that the farmers were responding to all these incentives, and secondly, the cash payment was preferred even in the cases where insurance was the premium from the insurance was better than the cash. That so again, that's something which is telling us that those insurance and all those things, they are not yet internalized by the farmers. They still don't know them. So that's one of the reasons. So in conclusion, we are saying that ISFM adoption could be increased by looking at offering the short-term training to the agricultural extension agents about ISFM, climate change, and other new changes. And farmers can strongly respond to these incentives. So we can change the subsidy program currently by giving them on conditions that the farmers have planted agroforest trees. Now, I talked in the beginning that the ISFM is labor intensive, but agroforest is not as labor intensive as the manure that I'm talking about. You plant the trees on 1 year, you're done. You're not going to be hauling manure again. So, and the studies have been showing that you can cut by more than 50% if you plant what they call the fertilizer trees, the leguminous trees that have fixed a lot of nitrogen. So this is something which is good. This is something that USAID, I'm talking to people who influence the policies in Africa, please prod those people to give the condition, the subsidy on the condition that there is some agroforest and all other organic inputs. It's going to be a lot of benefits in terms of reducing the risk, in terms of increasing the yields, and also cutting down the amount of subsidy that they are currently giving. Thank you very much.
Okay. Let's try this again. We're going to shift gears again. This time we're going to talk about paradigms. We're going to try and do something on the order of 30 or 40 years, 50 years of transformation of how we look at the adoption of technological practices in agriculture. So it's the second phase, the technological change that we're going to talk about here. The first phase was unlike the first phase, the second phase is perhaps more studied. And the study has been framed and shaped, and the way we approach and have thought about technological change in agriculture has been shaped by Everett Rogers more than anybody else. I remember coming in here to USAID back in the 70s and seeing his models. It's really, really shaped our mentality and our psyches tremendously. And it advanced us and advanced him, and we'll see some of his progression through time as well. It was a 1962 book that did that. We're going to shift from that perspective to an innovation systems perspective that is 21st century. And we're going to do that. We're going to talk about the identity of actors and how our conception of who the actor is and how they're defined, how we characterize them changes. We're going to talk about the dynamics of time. To what extent is time a dimension in all this, and how do actors and innovations change over time? And finally, we're going to talk about innovation and whether innovation is an object or a process, and how it's through those, considering those three different types of factors in the paradigms, we'll see how we have evolved over time. This is going to be a necessarily really quick and superficial overview, but we'll try and bear with me, and then we can talk about it later. Rogers' division of innovations. Basically, the actors were identified by cuts underneath the bell curve. We had innovators, early adopters, early majority, late majority, laggards. That's how we characterized actors. Based on the time frame. Time is only relevant as its passing alters the percentage of the population that has adopted the technology. And innovations are seen as transferable static objects, unchanging. More dynamic models. They recognize change over time. The process, that there's been more processes of adoption modeled in various econometric designs, as well as others. These approaches have emphasized changes occurring over time in learning and in market conditions. They recognize the influence of market networks and relative market positions, and realize that early adopters change the landscape for later adopters. This is not the same situation anymore. On drawing on agent-based models, technology diffusion could be modeled in a landscape over time. And we've got some interesting stuff that's going on that really looks at landscapes and how the different parts of the landscape receive new practices. However, most still assume that the innovation itself does not change. That things are being adopted without adaptation. Adoption, adaptation. Those are the two words we want in our heads, and we want to lose the word. I did this at the Soil and Water Conservation Society at the beginning of the last phase of SANRAM when we went to conservation agriculture. So we want to get rid of that word adoption. Just forget it. Adaptation. That's the word of the 21st century. Over time, we've come to learn about the importance of actor interactions and social learning. This alters our categorization of actors from various classes of adopters to innovators and imitators, those that are performing different roles. So the actor performs roles. It's not just a static thing that is cut off in a percentage of when something happened. Heinrich, in 2001, explored this dynamic, arguing that biased cultural transmission was the predominant force for diffusion. That is, copying others who are perceived as role models. This could be because of prestige or similarity, charisma. There are a number of different factors that may be involved in a particular process. Heinrich argues that the purely environmental learning, where decisions are based on something like cost-benefit analysis, you calculate it, you've got it. You've got the answer, and so it creates an R-shaped curve, like you see on the right here. This R-shaped curve is the inflection point is at the beginning. The rate of adoption, if you like, the frequency of the trait in the population increases rapidly at the beginning and then levels out. Most situations, however, are best expressed by the S-curve over here, which is the cumulative density function of the earlier shown bell curve. And this is because there's a long tail at the beginning. There's a slowness of an initial adoption relative to the rate of which individuals will imitate previous adopters. And then it accelerates later on if it's going to pass through the entire population or through the population that it passes through. As the frequency of a trait in a population grows, it becomes more valuable. Thus, the prestige of the initial adopter can influence the popularity of an idea or practice. This also pertains to the influence of religious groups on small farmer adoption as well. The social network findings of Granovetter demonstrate that economic behavior is embedded in the network of interpersonal relations. So we're moving from the analysis just a simple adoption of innovation to some other factors, some other learnings that we've learned about the dynamics of interaction and social learning. Successful adaptation of innovation practices appears to involve vast networks of relationships that reinforce certain sets of knowledge and beliefs and behaviors and not others. From these agent-based theories and models emerged a perspective where networks of farmers and other stakeholders interact, and technological innovation arises from that interaction. Here, the concept of social learning moves beyond the idea that our actors are influenced by one another to the notion of stakeholders coming together to collaborate for the purpose of technological or institutional innovation. This leads to the discussion of a broadened conception of what innovation is. Recognizing that integrated soil fertility management is a complex technology, we can see the relevance of Rycroft and Cash's work on innovation systems in the 1990s, when we're looking at industries in general and what constitutes innovation. It's huge literature out there to take advantage of. And one of the key things that they noted was the continuous innovation of complex technology can only be carried out by diverse groups and individuals that are parts of communities. Some studies move beyond the studying of the diffusion of static innovation to the study of the innovation process itself, describing innovation as a reflective and continuous process in which actors seek to maintain equilibrium with their constantly changing environment. They're doing contingent decision making. It's not a static moment that you can capture and model at that time. As things change, as climate changes, as the market changes, decision-making must adjust and adapt. Sarah Campbell described the process of innovation in terms of adaptive management and social learning, recognizing that knowledge is a fluid, constantly changing outcome of socio-material relations. Recent work has applied this revised conception of innovation that comprises institutional and organizational change. Okay. In exploring the second phase, we've identified a paradigm shift, which offers new conception of actor identities, time dynamics, innovations, and the relationships between them. There's a greater recognition of the role of actor interaction and social learning. A deeper analysis of time dynamics reveals that as time progresses, innovations themselves are adapted to fit changing needs and conditions. This has led to the shift in the perception of innovation as an unchanging, diffusible object to an ongoing dynamic process. Within these processes, there is not a single moment of individual decision making, rather a continuous process of group negotiation and adaptation. So soil management is in complex adaptive systems, involves constant adaptation to changing climatic and conditions and markets. All partners are learning and adapting simultaneously. It's an interacting network and system that's moving forward through time, changing as it moves. We still recognize the farmers as the key actors that we want to focus on, but we take them in their context and the elements that shape their decision making. So how does this innovation system paradigm change our approach to fostering technological change in agriculture? Innovation networks and platforms foster social learning and a collaborative, farmer-driven innovation process. They are the forum for negotiation between local and scientific knowledge, which allows innovation to become a result of the negotiation. Innovation networks emerge when different actors realize a mutual desire to improve a project or process. They are composed of farmers, farm organizations, extension, input suppliers, researchers, agencies, policymakers, and many others. Strong networks foster access to knowledge and physical inputs, increasing farmers' access to options. Strengthening network ties improves the flow of information between local actors. Innovation networks may form organically or be deliberately constructed. Innovation platforms are deliberately formed innovation networks. Innovation platforms create an environment that fosters the process of innovation by assembling a variety of stakeholders to identify and resolve systematically interdependent issues in a production network. Essential to innovation platforms is the role of the innovation broker. Innovation brokers are needed to catalyze the process of innovation. A broker is an individual, an organization with a neutral role in the system who fosters collaboration. Innovation brokers are needed to listen, mediate, coordinate various stakeholders. That is to help translate, to help facilitate communication, to make communications competent. Okay. As Ephraim was saying, the extension agents need to go back to school. Unfortunately, it's not that simple. We need to start thinking about what we're talking about in school. I guess the critical thing is that agricultural extension agents are trained in conventional production practices in the first case, that's what Ephraim's point was, and that the way they're taught science is as a matter of facts that they memorize. The educational system is a memorization system, so that science is something that you memorize and then you can tell people forever what it is without it ever changing. This is the core of this communication problem. We've got wonderful science of how we can improve soil fertility management. We've got farmers who are doing their best to survive with multiple economic demands and resources, and we're not really talking really well with each other. So we need to develop agents who are skilled facilitators, negotiators, linguists, translators. What do they need to be doing? They need to be formulating messages to influence stakeholders. And that scientific knowledge needs to be credible, salient, and legitimate. Listening is perhaps the most important skill. We've traditionally favored credibility in science. But is the message salient? Is it relevant? Does it answer a question that a farmer has? Is it legitimate or fair? Does it really take them into account and recognize them and what they know? And build on that. Serious negotiation activities will involve translation and are required to assure the participation of multiple stakeholders from various audiences simultaneously. Okay, so local context matters. At the beginning of the presentation, I proposed that small farmer decision making could be analytically differentiated into two phases. The first frames the problem, revealing the local context, local ecology, knowledge, household livelihood strategies, belief systems, networks, leadership, each play a role. These factors, however, do not come together in any universal fashion, replicated from one situation to the next, as efforts to scale up technological fixes often assume. In the second phase, I showed how our conception or paradigm of innovation and technological change in agriculture has evolved over the course of since 62, that's over 50 years. This leads to a new understanding of innovation and a transformation in the meaning of adoption to that of adaptation. Because innovation is not simply an individual act, but part of a process of social learning involving a multitude of partners and adaptation to changing circumstances. Support for building innovation platforms for integrated soil fertility management becomes self-evident. A challenge to implementing this lack is the lack of trained innovation brokers. Thank you.